logical ethics, unknown misery.
Your business, man, you a genius.
Loud, mathematic, production by Soul for Hire. Tragic days.
I don't wanna die by the hands of my brother like Cain. In the eyes of my mother, seen her drowning with pain. It's the cries of my people disregarded in vain. Single mothers left to struggle, no one guarded the brain. Welfare, healthcare, whoever started the game. From cradle to the grave, they wanna treat us like slaves. Don't need a quarter, need a change, they can't amount to bills. To put the borders on my land, we got some mouths to fill. Without a chance, choking with bail, they choke with ropes. Turn the hope into dope, cause they hope will be choked. But I'm defiant, stand firm with my lines. Burn the Bible on the pile. Colonize upon the tyrant, remain a rebel to the devil's systematic ways. Remain strong for the cause through these tragic days.
The banging guns won't stop gun violence, changing mindsets will.
Now let's go. Mixtape.
I'm trapped in a whirlwind. Wrote tons of rhymes for songs you never heard spin. A burden I'm born to bear. In my own version, if you listen, you hear. The hunger and the passion, my emotion prepare. Together with the ganja sparked up in the flare. Yeah, my stomach touching my ribs. My food fed to my kids. But I gotta hold on, cause it's feeling like a long bed. The young black and gifted, I'm born to rise. White collar stepping and industrialized. We must realize civilized a barbarian is dwelling inside. It was a state of emergency.
It gets deep at the altar. I'm tired of my people walking like sheep for the slaughter. To my brothers blasting guns with your African tongue. Still we dance to the rhythm of the African drum. Yo, this land was built on bloodshed, enough dead. So what's next? I'm sick of these histories missing me. Enough said. Genocidal wars on the black and the poor. Families torn, got me knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. But all I hear is whispers followed by a slither. Souls quiver in the winter, will the father deliver? Blood in my eyes, lost the love of my life. And there is nothing I can do but bring my life to a new. A phoenix spawned from these ashes while you're lost in the traffic. The cost could be tragic, have you barked in the casket? It's one thing we know how to survive. Change with the times, I'm taking back what was rightfully mine.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM. Broadcasting from the basement of Carruthers Hall, Queen's University Campus, Kingston, Ontario, Turtle Island, and you're listening to The Massive. And my name is DJ Fraz. I'm here with two other awesome DJs who are very eager to be here and excited.
This is DJ M, and I'm here today to have a good time.
A good time. It's February 28th.
Great time. February 28th, Monday, 7 p.m. on The Massive.
Hi, I'm Jay Rogue, making a second appearance here at The Massive. Happy to be back. Surprised that I was asked.
The demand has been so high, Jay Rogue. You have no idea. The phone has been ringing off the hook.
I would like to be modest and say that I'm surprised.
Yeah, actually, I think that ringing was because of the funding drive.
We all make excuses.
Also, thank you to all those who donated during the funding drive to CFRC to keep us on air.
Yep, and thank you to that one person who called in and said, "That crazy girl threatened me." Thank you, Mary. This person doesn't actually exist. I was just making a joke. Everyone calm down.
Okay, and on that note, we're going to start off today's show with some community announcements.
Culture Shock is an anti-racist publication that strives to provide a form of artistic expression for those who have been historically and are currently marginalized. Culture Shock is seeking submissions for its anti-racist review. You're seeking poems, prose, photography, music, paintings, comics, spoken word, essays, anything you want to share with them. You can send your work to cultureshock@ams.queenc.ca for large items such as audio, high resolution photos, etc. Please send these items to faith.16@gmail.com. And yes, it's going to be published in late March 2011. All submissions are welcome.
Aren't you applying to that, dear?
Yes, I'm actually submitting a poem.
Nice.
Oh, DJM.
Mildly talented.
You should also submit, listeners.
You want to be as cool as her.
Totally.
Impossible. The Lavana Gender Advocacy Center is having a feminist reading group, which meets once a month to discuss a different text and or book. And this month, we're reading Borderlands, La Frontera, the new...
Mestiza,
by Gloria
Anzaldúa.
Thank you. This book is available at a bookstore's like Novel Idea, or borrow a copy from... for free at Lavana's library. It's at the Gray House, and the library's like Kingston Frontenac Public Library and the Stauffer Library. Come and discuss on March 9th at 6:30 p.m. at the Central Library branch of Kingston Frontenac Public Library in the brochure room. 130 Johnston Street. Everyone is welcome, really.
Also, the Prisoner Correspondence Project, which is a project run by Cooper Concordia out of Montreal, are seeking queer and trans people interested in becoming a pen pal to queer and trans prisoners. So their current waiting list for folks who are in prison is about 3 to 6 months, where previously it used to be about 6 weeks. So there's a really huge increase in demand. So if you think you might be interested, check out their website, www.prisonercorrespondenceproject.com/get-involved. And you can contact them from their info on their website. You can get more information about what it means to like be a pen pal, what's involved. And if it's something you might be interested in, you should shoot them an email.
I'm totally joining that. That sounds awesome, for real. So if I'm doing it, follow my lead and follow this paper.
The bar has been set.
I don't know how I can continue to do this, setting this bar so high.
We'll see.
For International Women's Week, there's an event going on at the Sexual Assault Center, Kingston, Monday, March 7th, titled An Historical Perspective on Violence Against Aboriginal Women and Girls. It's going to be from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. It's free admission. It's a presentation and discussion of the history of violence against Aboriginal women and girls. Event will also include Aboriginal drumming and singing, sponsored by Kingston Interval House, Women and Children's which is a women's and children's shelter, Kingston, Ontario, and Sexual Assault Center, Kingston. For more information, you can contact someone on 613-546-183, extension 22. So please make it a priority to attend this event. There's also another event happening
that I'm going to talk about.
DJM just got talking, man.
I didn't let her. which you want to do together? Okay. Monday, March the 7th. The feminization of poverty. From 5:30 to 7 p.m. Dunning Hall, room 11, 94 University Avenue. We are all aware of the social consequences of new liberalism, the creation of class disparity, and the perpetuation of poverty. Moreover, the poverty as a result of capitalism is gendered, leading to an effect known as the feminization of poverty, and a discussion held by Education on Gender Issues and Students Against Poverty. Guest speakers from the community will shed light insight on this phenomenon from both academic and grassroots activist approaches. This event will be catered. I said this with such gravity because it deserves it.
All right, and there's a full week's worth of events for International Women's Week, which runs from March 5th to 13th. You can check out the schedule at wedontstopkingston.com, all one word. On this week's show, we're going to hear the final version or the final part of a three-part documentary series that we've been airing here on The Massive for Black History Month in Kingston. The documentary is called Experiences of Blackness in Kingston. It was produced by Queens alumna Anna Thomas, and we've already aired the first two parts. We're very excited to air the final one here today. So I guess, do we maybe want to talk a bit more about what the documentaries are about, and also like thoughts on like the first two parts and like what people thought of them, and yeah.
The first part was amazing, and the second part was amazing as well, and I'm sure that the final one's gonna be amazing as well. It was really interesting as a personal color getting to listen to other people share the experiences about blackness in Kingston and how they experience sense of community or alienation in Kingston. It was really interesting and informative. It was a good project.
Yeah, it was really it was really almost therapeutic to hear that, like reflect these shared experiences, and I felt that was really great, and I'm glad that this is out there, like it's heard, like these voices are being heard. But also, to be honest, I felt it really sad. Like, it was just how so many other people are feeling, like, this isolation and, like, this confusion within Kingston and, like, Queen's University's, like, complete, like, complete denial. But, like, as an administration, like, a denial of this happening and, like, a refusal to really deal with it in, like, a systematic, institutional way instead of, like, making, like, broad, so-called liberal, like, you know, pronunciations, like, I don't know, like, how the mayor on his website had, like, talked about Black History Month, but, like, not actually having, like, a paid facilitator to, like, facilitate events in Kingston. So it was really both, like, affirming, but also really saddening, like, the disparity between people's experiences and, like, how it's actually reflected back at them by the, like, the institutions that they're in, which are supposed to support them, theoretically. I don't know, just, it was sad, like, it was just so sad for me, it was so sad. It was just, like, and just, like, the whole idea of, like, a community, like, but, like, you build this community with the, like, people who you connect with, who understand your experiences, even if they consider themselves to be, like, allies or other people of color. But it's also, like, these people leave so quickly, and I really can't even blame them because of this, like, isolation, and they feel here, and the denial that's perpetuated by Queen's University. And so, like, I feel like that community seems to be so fragile and so fluid. Like, it's here 1 second and, like, gone the next because people can't take it. And so I feel like almost like Kingston robs you of that.
Yeah, and that was definitely, like, reflected in a lot of people's, like, experiences that they talked about, which was, like, one thing that I thought was, or that was, like, really interesting was the man who was talking about this, like, brief period where he, like, had, like, a reggae club in Kingston and, like, about the community that, like, evolved, like, in that space and around that space, but then how it, like, eventually sort of, like, faded and he, like, lost the business and, like, yeah, it was, like, really, definitely, like, really, really sad and, like, really fucked up. It was, like, also in another way I was like, wow, this is, like, really amazing to, like, hear these people, like, talk about their experiences here and to, like, hear their, like, testimonies, like, of, like, survival and, like, more than, like, survival of, like, resistance also while, like, living here, which is, like, also really amazing to hear.
I was like, who are you? I want to be your friend. Oh my gosh, it's more than me. My three best friends. I'll have a potluck. For real.
And stay tuned, you'll hear the final part of the documentary series Experiences of Blackness in Kingston right after this track from Lauryn Hill.
Just a little girl, skinny legs and press and curl. My mother always thought I'd be a star. Way before the record deal, streets that nurtured Lauryn Hill made sure that I never go too far. Every ghetto, every city and suburban place I've been make me recall my days in the New Jerusalem. Story starts in Hooterville. Grew up next to Ivy Hill when kids were stealing quarter bills for fun. Killed a guy in Carter Park. Rode a mongoose till it's dark. Watching kids show off the stolen ones. Every ghetto, every city, and suburban place I've been made me recall my days in the New Jerusalem. You know it's hot, don't forget what you got. Looking back, looking back, looking back, looking back, looking back. You know it's hot, don't forget what you got. Looking back, looking back, looking back, looking back. Vagabond times 20 cents and a nickel. Spring till Lab had the best popsicles. Saturday morning cartoons and kung fu. Main Street Roots tonic with the dress. A beef patty and some cocoa bread. Move the patch from my leaves to the tongue of my shoe. Remember, Freeland Heisen used to have the bomb leather. Back when Doug Fresh and Slick Rick was together. Looking at the crew, we thought we'd all live forever. Yeah. You know it's hot, don't forget what you got. Looking back, looking back, looking back, looking back. You know it's hot, don't forget what you got. Looking back, looking back, looking back, looking back. Drill teams on Munn Street. Remember when Hawthorne and Chancellor had beef? Moving records was on Central Ave. I was there at dancing school, South on Javits, ball and pool, unaware of what we didn't have. Writing my friends' names on my jeans with a marker, July 4th races outside Parker, fireworks in Martin Stadium. The untouchable PSP, all the crazy niggas, McCarthy got away through Irvington. Hillside brings beef with the cops. Self-destruction record drops. And everybody's name was Muslim. We've been producing
sensations in 88. Dragged the kids from out of state. And everybody used to do the wop. Jack, jack, jack your body. Not a Bismarck used to amp up the party. I wish those days they didn't stop. Every ghetto, every city and suburban place I've been. Man, me recall my days in every city. You know it's high, don't forget what you got. Looking back,
looking back,
looking back, looking back.
From Appendix B, Baptisms, Marriages, and Deaths of Black People in the Kingston, Ontario, and Bay of Quinte region, up to and including 1834, as contained in church registers, from the MA thesis of Sherry Edmonds Flett. Sarah Bell married Samuel Scott, January 1818. Mary Bevan, interred July 19th. Colored child baptized, November 16, 1834. A Negro, died June 12, 1820. A black boy, buried September 20, 1794. Thomas Bond, a Negro, and Mary Peck, married 20th of May, 1817. Nancy, baptized December 25th, 1795. Jamie Brown and Mary Lewis, married November 20th, 1819. Catherine, a slave, interred December 28th, 1811. Sarah Davis and Thomas Tisman, both Africans, married November 15th, 1812. Dennis, baptism. Eva Dennis, colored girl, aged 12. Interred October 28th, 1828. Thomas Freeman, colored pauper, 40 years old. Interred January 11th, 1830. Eva Fresman, married Smith, 2nd of May, 1822. A black woman was buried June 28, 1804. The general consensus about black history in Kingston is that there are few records about the few people who have lived here over the past two centuries. Yet, in conducting this research for Oprah Kingston, I found pockets of detailed history, and, most importantly, resources within the community whose expertise and generosity have enabled this section of the project. The following documentary about the early Black Kingston residents will include interviews with Professor Barrington Walker of Queen's University and Sherry Edmonds Flett, former Kingston resident, whose 1988 MA thesis at UCLA was titled Slavery in the Kingston and Bay of Quinte Region. Professor Barrington Walker, the first black Canadian scholar to achieve a tenured position, met with us to discuss the broader historical context of blacks in Canada. Can you talk a little bit about your own academic career and what's brought you to here?
Well, I suppose there's the experiential part of it, being a person of of African descent and in living in Canada and being curious about the history of blacks in this country before my own parents arrived in the 1960s. There was always kind of a void. There wasn't much conversation in my family about, what folks often call indigenous black Canadian history. The historical lens in my family tended to, and a lot of the sensibility was West Indian and Caribbean, right? As is, I think, maybe expected as the child of West Indian immigrants. When I got to university in the late 1980s, I started my undergraduate degree in 89. My interest was really, especially by my second year of university, I went to York University, my interest is really African-American history, partly because of my upbringing and because of my miseducation in schools. I didn't really think that there was a black Canadian history to speak of, a significant black Canadian history. I knew a few things, the usual Underground Railroad stuff that I think most people hear, but no real idea that there was a history that, a significant history that dated over several centuries. And really, to be honest, I pursued this interest in political theory and black U.S. And black U.S. history up until graduate school. I mean, my master's degree was really in the history of the American South. And once I had this meeting with this woman, I don't even remember her name. There was a symposium at U of T where I did my master's degree. And she asked me what I do. And I said, oh, I'm working on the American South, race relations in the American South. And she looked at me and she said, well, are you American? And I said, no. And she said, are you from the South? And I said, no. She says, well, isn't there a history of black people that you could be talking about in Canada? And then that was it. And then I decided to go on and do a PhD. And I also decided to switch my research interest to Canadian and to study blacks in Canada. So I don't know who this person is, but I owe my career to her.
How did slavery function in Canada? And how is it different to the representations of what we see predominantly of like southern U.S. chattel slavery?
Slavery in Canada, like slavery everywhere in the so-called New World, was not a monolith, right? It was heterogeneous. And slaves had different experiences based upon geography, who owned them, a range of factors. But mm-hmm. if one was to draw broad strokes, slavery in Canada, in my view, more resembled slavery in the northern United States, mm-hmm. In that the climate didn't support agricultural slavery, right? You don't have big cotton, indigo, and sugarcane plantations like you'd have in the Caribbean and the southern United States. You didn't have task labor. I don't know if you know what task labor is, but where slaves are assigned to do like one particular task on a plantation, or gang labor, where they're all, which is remotely similar to task labor. Unlike some parts of the states, particularly like the Sea Islands in South Carolina and in the Caribbean, where you had black majorities, frankly, and relatively small numbers of whites or absentee white slave owners, which is one of the patterns in the Caribbean, don't have that in Canada. Like the United States, blacks are in the main greatly outnumbered by whites, and there's a lot of blacks who are engaged in artisanal pursuits, cobblers, that sort of thing. Carpenters, cobblers. There's a lot of what we would call sort of skilled labor now, and obviously a lot of preponderance of domestic labor. So you'll find in places like New France that most of the folks who own black slaves, because there are also Aboriginal slaves as well, the Pani, most of those folks are quite wealthy people, and indeed to the point where black slaves are who are more expensive than Aboriginal slaves are seen by some as objects of luxury, right? It's a real status symbol to say you own black slaves. And then later, after the so-called British conquest and the British takeover of slavery, I mean, the pattern remains more or less the same. a lot of domestic slavery, you know, some slaves working on farms, but not the kind of large-scale plantation agriculture that you see in sort of iconic representations of slavery, like, I don't know, Roots and Gone with the Wind, right? That's not the pattern in the Canadian context.
How would you describe the movement from the small rural communities of blacks to an overwhelmingly urban black population that we see now?
How would I explain it?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's ever asked me that question before. Well, I mean, the easy answer to that, or one easy answer to that question, is that it, you know, it reflects trends in the general population. If you look at the Canadian census at the turn of the century, I don't know the exact figures, but most of the population earn their living on the land. And, right, you see the Canadian population migrating to large urban centers with the phenomenon of industrialization and urbanization. As those two things intensify, so do the percentage of people who earn their living on the land decrease, right? So there's a broader pattern of urbanization and what the Marxists called proletarianization that takes place in the general community, which I think is also true of people of African descent. So that's true. So the earlier waves of African immigrants are, you know, descendants of slaves who are, you know, slaves don't own the means of production, but they're mainly engaged in sort of small-scale artisanal or agricultural pursuits. And that's reflected in the ways in which people of African descent make their livings in the period after slavery, mm-hmm. right? They talk about opening up factories. They talk about, you know, being... That's, as a matter of fact, you know, that's the ideal of freedom for blacks, the black loyalists, owning your own plot of land, farming your own plot of land. And that's a common theme, I think, throughout emancipated slave populations. But as the economy changes, so too do the ways in which blacks make their living. I think there is a process, a difficult process, that we don't know too much about, in all honesty, of proletarianization that takes place amongst blacks. Engage in industries like forestry, the coal industry out in the Maritimes, that sort of thing. Some of these folks are West Indians, but that's a long story. So there's that. And then I think in the period after, in the period, say, turn of the century, you see blacks engaged in occupations that kind of mirror slavery in a way, but are really more market-oriented, that they're doing it for a living. So that's a very garbled way of saying you see a lot of blacks in things like domestic service, which kind of speaks to, for black women, their experiences as slaves, but it's now they're being paid to do this kind of work, but there's an image of, you know, black women doing a particular kind of work, and that's domestic service. And for black men, I think that's mirrored in a lot of the occupations that black men are afforded as well, particularly, you know, like the whole idea of working as sleeping car porters in the Canadian context as well. To call it slavery is a bit harsh, but there are resonances, right, with the idea of folks who had personal servants, and that was very much the role that porters had in the post-World War II period. I think you're well into the period of Canadian industrialization, and that's reflected in the kinds of work that people come to do. Yeah, there's always been agricultural labor, people who engage in commercial agriculture, immigrants, but what you see is post-World War II, post-point system, a lot of folks coming over to be involved in the industrialized economy, and knowledge workers as well, students and knowledge workers. So that's a very, like, sort of, yeah, I think that's accurate. I think, yeah, I think it's, so goes the economy, and so goes the changing nature of migration. That's where you get that move from the rural to the city. I don't think that's a story that's exclusive to blacks at all, actually.
Okay, so my name is Sherry Edmonds Flett. I was born in Kingston, Ontario. My family has lived in Kingston and since the year 1800 on my mother's side.
Sherry, how did you first become interested in studying black history in Kingston?
I became interested in studying Black history in Kingston because, one, as I said, I'm from Kingston, and two, I've been very interested in Black history and literature from an early age. In fact, I think one of the first books I ever read was Margaret Walker's Jubilee, and Margaret Walker is an African-American writer. Mm-hmm. At her book Jubilee, and I can remember getting it out of the Calvin Park Library and was just thrilled. I'm not Black myself, I'm white, but I'm really interested in it because I feel like I find myself where I am, I recognize myself in a lot of the writing that I see, like especially by women writers who are of African descent, and I just have been very interested.
Sherry's thesis gathers vital primary research on the lives of early Black Kingston residents. Her extensive and specific research into births, deaths, marriages, land transactions, and details of slave-owning families in the region demonstrate the distinct presence of Blacks. As part of the Kingston Black History Project, Sherry's previously unavailable thesis has been digitized and will soon be available at the Queen's University Archives. The effort she has put into collating and gathering this information should dispel any belief that data does not exist on Blacks in Kingston, while the length of her bibliography suggests it certainly wasn't a simple process.
So what would you identify as a timeline of key dates to Kingston's Black history?
Okay. Key dates would be the American Revolutionary War, that's the War of 1776. Because Kingston basically wasn't settled by, I mean, we obviously had Aboriginal people living in the Kingston area, but it wasn't settled by people that weren't Aboriginal till basically, well, we had in Cataraqui, we had French people that came and were there, as they said, from, I think it was in 1673, I think, but we didn't have people that I know of that brought slaves, at least people of African descent, and as slaves until the American Revolutionary War. So I'd say that was one. Then the next one I'd say would be the ban on importation of slaves into what we now know as Ontario. Mm-hmm. Then the next one would be the end of slavery in the British Empire, which was the proclamation was granted 1833, went into effect 1834. And then I would say the end of the Civil War, or American Civil War. Because of that, you have a lot of people that either went back to the States to live. It just sort of changed the complexity of it, or changed how it was. Because after the end of, when slavery was abolished in Canada, or in the British Empire, that's when you basically start having people coming up to what we now know as Canada to escape under the quote-unquote Underground Railroad. But a lot of people don't know is that prior to that, like between the American Revolutionary War and the end of slavery in the British Empire, we actually had people going south to try to escape slavery here in what we now know as Canada. So I'd say the end of the American Civil War, and then the next point I would say would be the end of the 19th century, because basically I think we have to look at Kingston's economy at the time, because what I found in what I've researched about our African Canadian community in Kingston is a lot of people started moving out to bigger cities like Montreal, Toronto, etc. And by the turn of the 19th century, there wasn't the sizable Black community that we had, that, you know, we didn't have as many people of African descent as we had before. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether, and I would say that was linked to, like Kingston, I don't think had the same prominence that it had in earlier, like, you know, when we were potentially going to be the capital of Canada, or we had, I think, briefly, if I remember correctly, or if, you know, we were, you know, a sort of like the point for, a terminus point for transportation routes and stuff, and a lot of that stuff. A lot of those things started to change, and so Kingston's, so I think you could also key as to why people of not as many people of African descent were there in Kingston due to economic factors of the city as a whole. So,
the American Revolutionary War saw a major influx of immigration to the Kingston area. Black people who were part of this migration had a complicated relationship with their new home and, often, their continued slavery.
But nearly all of the black people brought into Upper Canada, which is Kingston was part of Upper Canada, during this time were slaves, property of loyalists fleeing the states such as Vermont, New Jersey, New York. And also black people were brought into the province through a series of skirmishes and raids conducted by the British into the northern United States. So slaves were also taken as spoils of war by the loyalist soldiers and native people sympathetic to the British Crown and brought into Canada. And sometimes slaves who felt they were free as they had surrendered to the British and joined the loyalist cause found themselves to be enslaved still. Now, John Johann Joost Herkimer, there was a fellow by the name, a person who was enslaved named Cornelius, who said, "I'm not a slave. I was actually a free loyalist." He went in front of a board, which was called the Civil and Provincial Secretary of Lower Canada, and the civil board, and said, he said he had been sold in the States as confiscated property, and he had joined the British Army afterwards on the faith of a proclamation promising manumission to such who would quit their masters and join the standard, in other words, be on the side of the British. Herkimer, Jan Joost Herkimer, replied to the board that if the commissions for claims allowed his claim for the loss of this Negro Cornelius, he would manumit him, in other words, free him. Meanwhile, the wife of Cornelius, Judith Johnson, wrote a letter to the board received by them August the 12th, 1787.
The complaint of the subscriber inhabitant of the neighborhood of Cataraqui that 7 months' provisions is withheld from her by McLean or his assistant, that she has not received cloths or nails or any kind of utensils as other loyalists have done, that her husband, formerly a slave of Captain Herkimer, was sold by the rebels in the country and afterwards made his escape and came to this place or province of Canada and joined the king's service and served during the war, whereas agreeable to the king's proclamation, he ought to have had his freedom, but still is kept a slave by Herkimer. Judith Johnson.
So, that same day, August the 12th, 1787, the board said that Herkimer had changed the value of Cornelius, and that's sort of like the strategic thing, because in other words, Herkimer was saying that he would free him, but that the board need to be compensating for the loss. So, and in the end, though, the board decides in favor of Herkimer, saying that Judah Johnson is not entitled to tools, etc., and was struck off the provision list. So they weren't considered to be free black loaves.
Sherry's research unearths fascinating narratives amongst stark details. Reverend John Stewart was a former missionary to the Mohawks in Fort Hunter, New York, and later in Montreal. On arriving in Kingston, he became the minister of St. George's Anglican Church, the first church built in Kingston. Reverend Stewart's slaves were said to participate in church services, lighting candles, and attending to Stewart's needs. A letter Sherry found demonstrates his attitude towards these slaves.
Kingston, March 6, 1802. Dear James, a domestic occurrence has deranged us very much. On the 22nd of the last month, the coldest day experienced here for several years, my Negro boy, without any pretended reason whatever, ran away. He went on skates by the way of Carlton Island. On the 3rd, I heard that he was at a house about 30 miles distance, with a hand and foot frozen. I dispatched a person to bring him back. The people where he was told my messenger that they would neither prevent nor assist him in bringing the Negro back. Upon this, he returned here and took a horse and sleigh, as the fellow could not walk. But a few of the bandits of the place collected, and said that if the Negro would not go voluntarily back, they would not allow him to be compelled. Of course, he said he was not willing, and the man returned without him. And what mortifies me more than the loss, I hear that the fellow is at work publicly with a Republican, American rascal, who keeps the ferry in sight of Carlton Island. I have advertised and written to a magistrate on the Black River, New York, on this subject, but I have very little expectation that I shall ever recover the fellow. These democratic villains are not contented with ruining me once.
The boy appears to have returned only to escape again, as Reverend Stewart laments.
Kingston, March 4th, 1803. Dear James, I believe I mentioned to you that my Negro boy has gone again to the States. I despair of recovering him. This time the loss of him is more severely felt than formerly, as he was becoming so very serviceable.
Can you give us some idea of numbers?
There was a return done in 1784 that was that Riddell, in an article called The Slave in Canada, said that a large number of slaves were euphemistically disguised as servants in some cases. In the return for the Kingston Bay of Quinte region, the number of slaves per township were as followed. In the 2nd Battalion, which is townships 3 and 4 Cataraqui, there were 10. In Captain Grass's party, which is township 1 Cataraqui, apparently none. In part of Major Jessup's corps, which is township number 2 in Cataraqui, there were 12. In Major Rogers' corps, which is township number 3 Cataraqui, there were 14. And in Major Van Alstyne's party of loyalists, there were supposedly 17. And so Van Alstyne was in what we now know as Adolphus Town and out, you know, as you go outside of Kingston. So that became 53. So they said at that point in time in 1784 that there were 53. Now, at the same time, in a earlier, that's of slaves, but also there was also in the winter of 1783, there were some loyalists at Cataraqui and Carleton Island. And from what's known as the British Headquarter Papers, which have also sometimes been cited as the Haldimand Papers, and there was a return dated November the 26th, 1783, titled Return of the Loyalists, Male and Female at Carleton Island, specifying their age and number of rations drawn out of the King's store per diem. Of the 37 people who drew rations on this list, 7 of them were designated as Negro or Black. 3 of these people were women. One was named Violet. She was age 30. There was Juba and Jane Fundy, ages 23 and 20 respectively. The 4 men were Joe, age 27, Abraham Johnson, age 45, London, age 28, and Montreal, age 27. There's no way of knowing whether these people were slaves or free Black people, or whether they eventually ended up living in the Kingston area. Kingston in area, in the Bay of Quinte area. So obviously then our population, like our Black population, was smaller than it was in the Maritime provinces, but also where other Black loyalists had gone. But the thing also is too is that I would say just on the basis of what we read about Cornelius and Johnson and his wife, and as well as with Thomas Tinbrook, with the fact that he had only originally been given 50 acres, I would say that they had some of the same problems that Black loyalists had in the Maritime provinces, where they were given land that was poor or not given land at all, or there was that confusion around, well, am I considered a Black loyalist or am I considered a slave? But if you can imagine, here we have Black people that came with white loyalists that were still enslaved. Then you had Black people who said, well, no, I fought on the side of the British, so I shouldn't be a slave. So it's just a big mess.
The Black history of the Kingston area does not, of course, end after the period of so-called Black loyalism. People dispersed, assimilated, or like the Mink family, descended from Mink, Herkimer's slave, continued on to become prominent community members. The major institutions of the city are also deeply implicated in the Black history of the area. One institution I would personally like to pursue more is the history of the penitentiary in Kingston. The Queen's Archives holds microfilms of the punishment books from the Kingston Penitentiary in the 19th century, and looking through daily records of bodily punishments inflicted on all inmates serves as a reminder of how Kingston's history is intimately linked with that of the prison system in Canada. One man in particular stood out for me when I found him listed in the census as black and as residing in the Kingston Penitentiary. His name is Samuel Jackson, and in 1868 he was 24. On the 31st of January, 1868, he was punished, quote, for having in his possession a ring and wearing this on his finger when asked for it by the guard, he repeatedly refused to give it. Punishment: 6 meals of bread and water and 2 nights in dark cell. The next day, the 1st of February, 1868, he was punished with another inmate, James Moore, quote, for fighting with each other in the entrance to the tailor shop, Morin attempting to renew the fight in the shop, calling the other a damned nigger. Punishment: 2 dozen lashes with the cats, and be confined in the dark cell till further orders. Out of the blacks listed in Frontenac County, including communities around Kingston, in the 1871 census, 24 were in the penitentiary and 1 in the penitentiary's asylum. A total of 331 people were listed under the Kingston Penitentiary. We see here clearly that even as early as the 1870s, the disproportionate representation of blacks within the penal system in Canada was in evidence.
I think this was our final question, but how do you think the history of blacks in Canada, I mean, stemming from slavery and onwards, affects the forms of racism that are unique to or appear unique to Canada? Specifically in relation, I mean, you often hear the comparison between kind of the hard racism of the States and the kind of softer, polite, passive racism of Canada.
So, okay, the question is, how do the experiences of blacks, how has that manifested itself in kind of the more polite?
I think, how do you see the unique history of Canadian black history manifesting itself in the forms of racism we see today?
That's a really interesting question. And I think, no, that's good. And I think it's something that, frankly, I don't have an answer for, but something that I'm trying to work out with my stuff. I think we're all grappling with that question because in some respects, you know, it's not surprising that a population that was enslaved and largely despised should end up on the short end of all kinds of social indicators now. I mean, that's the work that history does in the present, right? The inequities that blacks face now across the board in terms of, you know, life expectancy and health, and I mean, you just name it. To me, these are the legacies of the ways in which blacks were treated. But you know, the other legacy that a lot of us struggle with, some people ignore it, some people don't know quite what to do with it. There is that long history of the more kind of subtle, less overt ways in which people of African descent are treated by the dominant population that I think is a really important part of the story. And it's not just something that emerges kind of in post-multiculti discourse, and it's not something that emerges just past the point system or the Declaration of Human Rights. That's been part of the black experience, which makes it, for me, infinitely more fruitful than studying black history in a lot of other places, even though the numbers aren't there as they are in other places, is that blacks don't face in Canada the same regime of legal restrictions and barriers they face in other places. So you don't have Jim Crow laws in the Canadian context, but you have in many places a culture of Jim Crowism. You don't have laws against miscegenation in the Canadian context. There's no law in the country that says thou shalt not marry a white woman, but you know, it's frowned upon. But at the same time, it's far more common than it is in certain parts of the United States. If you look at the census records, there's a fair bit of intermarriage that goes on, particularly black men marrying Irish women. You know, with regard to schools. There are no Jim Crow laws that come out and say blacks shall not attend schools with white students, but in practice, the schools are segregated. And then these patterns of segregation take on different, slightly different manifestations, you know, depending on where you go. So there's that whole legacy of what I've been calling in my work the liberal racial order, where on paper, blacks have equal rights, but in practice, oftentimes they have subordinate status. So it's trying to figure out what's going on between that space, between legal equality and societal inequality, that I think accounts for the complexity of the black experience in Canada. And it can't be fully understood by easy, often superficial comparisons to what goes on in the United States. It's a different political and social order, and I think people would be better off, I'm arguing in my work more and more, looking at the ways in which blackness is articulated across the British Empire. And in a cross-British Empire, than worrying about what goes on in the United States. That's a part of the story, but it's not going to fully explain what happens once black, say, American refugees actually get here and how they're dealt with legal institutions. Because what do you make of a country that refuses to extradite many slaves to the United States to stand trial for crimes, but at the same time will tacitly support white Canadians' right to discriminate against them in housing and education and employment? What do you do with that? So I still don't know. But it's going to be what I try to figure out for the rest of my life, because that's what I find really interesting. I think I've moved beyond this was like Tennessee and this was like Alabama. And I've moved beyond that. I want to try to understand this thing on its own terms. Yeah, that's what I want to do.
Fragments of history you have heard in this radio doc fascinate and intrigue you as much as they did me. I encourage you to look at Sherry Edmund Flett's newly digitized thesis and to contact me at anna.bay@gmail.com for further information or more conversation. I'd like to thank everyone who participated in these interviews. This project would have been nothing without your voices, passions, and experiences. Special thank yous go to Saida, Laura, and Avi for their teaching and technical support, to Fraser, Vlada, and Tom, who facilitated me finishing this project from across the pond, and to my assistant, Rosa, you are simply the best. Thank you. Black is the color of my true love's hair, of my true oh, I love my lover, and well he knows. Yes, I love the ground where he goes, and still I hope that the time will come when he and I will be as one.